property, the seller is required to sell. If the lease option is carefully structured, however, it can be good for both the buyer and the seller. When a buyer enters into a lease option with a seller, he or she is betting that the value of the property on a specified future date will be greater than the agreed-upon purchase price. Even if this doesn't happen, considerable equity may still be achieved as a result of the credits of some or all of the monthly payments from the purchase price. As a result, there is a high chance that by purchasing the property at the specified date and price, he or she will gain instant equity. If, however, the value of the property on the specified future date is less than the specified purchase price, the buyer can walk away from the contract or attempt to renegotiate the price. The seller is free to keep any option consideration, something of value, usually money, given as an inducement to enter a contract, that may have been paid and realize the gain from a monthly rental income. And if the buyer walks away, the seller is also free to start the process over, to either sell or rent or lease option the property. Here's a summary of benefits for the buyer. The risk is low and the financial leverage can be high. The buyer receives control and possession of the property. Very little or no initial closing costs. The buyer can walk away from the contract if the value of the property on the specified future date does not justify its purchase at the agreed-upon price, or the buyer can attempt to renegotiate the price or terms of the purchase. Benefits for the seller. The agreed-upon price of the property is frequently at the top of its current market value range. The option money that the seller receives is tax-deferred until exercised or expired. The option is forfeited if rent is not paid on time. The seller receives all the equity buildup, amortization, on the mortgage during the option period. The tenant has pride of ownership and, therefore, an incentive to take good care of the property. The rent, including the amount, if any, that is applicable to the option purchase price, is at the top of or above the fair market rental range. The ability to regain possession and control of the property in the event of the optionee's default in meeting the terms of the agreement. Tip. Over time, the real estate market is bound to change. The lease option technique allows both buyer and seller to take advantage of any market change and bridge the gap, so to speak, with minimal risk. Lease option contracts can be written to include several options for both buyer and seller. These can include the following. Lease optioning a property with the intent to sublease to another person with a purchase option. Sandwich lease. Lease optioning, then selling or assigning your position to a third party. Lease optioning a property requiring a modest rehab to sell to an end user or keep as a rental. The lease option can be used on commercial investment properties as well as residential or investment properties. Real life story, student success story number 3. This lease option was negotiated a number of years ago. The numbers may seem low, but the principles and the economics of the transaction are very much applicable in any market. The buyer, my student, owned a house worth roughly $100,000. There were a fair number of rental homes in the area, most of them rented in the $500 to $700 range. Seeking to find a substantially nicer home, the buyer sought out a nearby upscale town where the home values exceeded $200,000. Rentals in this upscale area were fairly scarce. The buyer found a home for sale for $220,000, and it appeared to be reasonably priced. The seller was very anxious to sell since he had already moved out of the state, and the home had been on the market for several months. The buyer proposed a lease option, and they ended up agreeing to a 4-year option at the asking price of $220,000. The monthly rent was $900, low for this particular house, but high in comparison to almost all other rentals in the surrounding areas. And the buyer received a 50% rent credit, $450 per month, toward the eventual purchase. The seller was to pay taxes and insurance during the option period, and the buyer agreed to pay for all of the maintenance. An inspection revealed that the house was in very good shape. The buyer put down $3,600 as a non-refundable deposit for the option consideration, which was equivalent to less than 2% of the option purchase price. The buyer was amazed when he figured out the effective interest rate that he was paying. He realized that of the $900 a month he was paying, only $450 was the true cost of owning the house. From that, he subtracted the cost of taxes and insurance, which were $340 per month, an amount he would have had to pay had he owned the property, to yield a net cost of $110 a month. This worked out to an incredible effective interest rate of 0.6%. $110 times 12 months equals $1,320 divided by $220,000, which equals 0.6%. That's less than 1%. After 3 years, the buyer was certain that he was going to exercise his option at the end of the 4-year period because, among other reasons, property values had been increasing very nicely in this area at about 7% per year. But he figured it was worth the effort to see if the seller would be willing to extend the option in exchange for some additional consideration. The buyer and seller ended up agreeing to extend the option for one additional year in return for the buyer paying $10,000 of additional option consideration, which meant that it would be fully applied to the purchase price, but it would be forfeited if the buyer did not buy the house. Was this a good move? I sure think so. Even if it cost the buyer 10% interest to borrow the $10,000 for a year, which is $1,000, it was a small price to pay for another year of ownership at the effective interest rate of less than 1%. After the 5-year period, the buyer exercised the option and obtained the necessary funds by simply securing an owner-occupied loan, loan programs specifically designed for owner-occupants, for $179,400, which was the total amount due to the seller. $220,000, less the deposit of $3,600, less the additional consideration of $10,000 paid in year 4, and less the rent credit of $27,000, which is equal to $450 for 60 months or 5 years. The property appreciated, and it appraised for $290,000. Thus, the new loan was for only 62% of the property's fair market value. By the way, the buyer eventually sold this house about a year later for $320,000, and you guessed it, has since moved on to an even nicer home. The buyer's profit on his initial investment of $3,600 was $90,000, based on the property appreciation of $70,000 and the $20,400 savings of not paying taxes and insurance while living in the house. Under a lease option like this, the buyer, and seller in this case, benefited in that the real estate taxes remained fairly steady throughout the 5-year period because there had not been a reported sale of the property. The action that the buyer took at the end of year 3, asking for and getting the seller to agree to an additional year's extension, is an excellent example of the power of creative thinking. This would have been a great investment even if that had not occurred. But by thinking creatively and being willing to ask questions, the buyer turned what was already a great investment into one that was even better. Let's take a look at how the buyer and the seller fared over this 5-year deal. Benefits for the buyer and the seller. For the buyer, flexibility of option to purchase any time within a 4-year term. This option was additionally extended for 1 more year. Out of the total monthly rental payment of $900, $450 is credited toward the purchase, which makes the cost of occupancy $450 a month. Initial down payment of $3,600 and subsequent option extension of $10,000 are credited directly against the purchase price. The buyer had the advantage of time to put himself in the position to buy a home that he might not otherwise have been able to afford. Based on appreciation of approximately 7% per year, the buyer will enjoy instant equity of $110,600, $290,000 fair market value minus $179,400 option purchase price balance. The buyer will have a much easier time obtaining favorable loan terms with $110,600 in equity in the property, and therefore needs a mere 62% LTV, loan-to-value, to pay off the balance of the option purchase price. For the seller, the seller received full asking price. The seller is relieved of all maintenance responsibility and cost associated with the property. The seller receives sufficient income to cover the property taxes, insurance, and the principal and interest payment on the existing mortgage, plus a monthly profit. The seller receives a non-refundable deposit up front. The seller retains the $54,000 in rent payments, $900 per month, and the $13,600 total option deposit if the buyer fails to exercise the option. If he exercises the option, the seller credits back these amounts against the purchase price. The seller enjoys the reduction of the loan principal, which increases the amount the seller will cash out at closing, or the equity the seller will have in the property if the buyer does not complete the transaction. The seller enjoys the deferment of taxes on the portion of money applied to the option purchase price, including the $3,600 and the $10,000 consideration, until the option is exercised or abandoned. The seller has the peace of mind of knowing that the property is under contract and is being maintained by someone motivated to take good care of it because hopefully he will soon own it. This story is a perfect example of how a lease option can be very powerful for the buyer and yet still represent an attractive proposition for the seller. To learn more about lease options and many other creative techniques to purchase property, go to www.carltonsheetsrealbook.com to view my free online programs. Putting it all into action. These are powerful techniques, but there is still one additional step that you need to take. Learning to negotiate and structure offers. The best creative financing in the world won't gain you anything if you don't use it as part of a well-planned strategy with terms that are favorable to you. It's not really as difficult as it may seem. You might even discover that you are a better negotiator than you thought you were. For me, it all begins with trust and credibility. For starters, keep in mind that people are naturally suspicious when it comes to conducting business with strangers. Yet, in more cases than not, we find ourselves, as either buyers or sellers, negotiating with people whom we are meeting for the very first time. The number one question on both parties' minds, therefore, is, who do I trust? Tip: use the seller's name in conversation. I once read a book that made the case that people are successful in life only to the degree that they are able to make people like and trust them. This is certainly true in negotiating. When talking to a seller, take a few minutes to establish a rapport. This builds a trusting relationship that is so essential to negotiating. If sellers feel comfortable with you, they often will be more forthcoming with important information, such as their true needs. So how do you convince a seller that you're on the up and up? How do you establish that magical relationship based on rapport? One of the simplest techniques is a very basic one. When you get the person's name, remember it. Write it down and be sure you get the right spelling. Then, when engaging him or her in conversation, be sure to use it. It isn't, "I'll tell you what." It's, "I'll tell you what, Joe." That's a quick and easy way to begin building a rapport with the seller. Tip: avoid being overly critical. You'll seldom, if ever, force the seller into lowering the price or terms by harsh criticism. Another important element of rapport and trust building is being a good listener. As you talk to the seller, remember to always be an empathetic listener. Imagine yourself in his or her situation and try to experience emotionally what the seller is experiencing. By doing so, you might gain a new perspective on the negotiation and be able to make an offer that the seller is more likely to accept. People like to know that they're being listened to. Using non-essential contingencies. Establishing a good rapport with someone is not in and of itself a negotiating strategy. It is merely one component of your overall approach. Compromise is what negotiations are all about. If you enter negotiations with an open mind, the seller is more likely to have an open mind too. This mindset allows both of you to create a win-win situation. During negotiations, both parties must give something to get something. Therefore, good negotiators always use non-essential but purposeful contingencies as negotiating tools. In other words, when you use a non-essential contingency, such as requesting that the seller include some or all of the furniture, you ask for concessions that you do not necessarily need or even want, concessions you are willing to negotiate away. In return, the seller concedes on a point that is important to you. By using non-essential contingencies, you will arm yourself with effective negotiating tactics. You might only want the seller to pay all of the closing costs, for example, but by adding the other non-essential contingencies, you have some extra items that you can give up to get the one that you truly want. Making multiple offers simultaneously. The traditional way that people make offers on real estate is to make one offer, wait for the seller to counteroffer, go back and forth once or twice on terms or price, and then come to an agreement. By making more than one offer simultaneously, you will be able to pinpoint what the seller's needs are and how your offer can meet his or her needs. Here are some multiple offer options. A cash offer at a deeply discounted price. An offer that incorporates seller financing. A lease option. Make sure all amounts are clearly stated. You may want to consider using a letter of intent when making multiple offers, or for that matter, with any type of offer you are making. A letter of intent is a letter stating a buyer's intent to make an offer to acquire a certain property. It is not a binding contract, but it shows a good faith desire to own the property. And it can be a real time saver compared with filling out a formal contract offer to purchase. If a seller responds in a positive way, it could be the basis for further negotiations. If you are proposing a creative way to purchase the property, it may be helpful because you can show exactly how the transaction will benefit the seller by using a letter of intent. In your letter of intent, you can bullet point two or three different scenarios that would work for you in purchasing the property. Make sure the seller understands that he or she cannot combine the offers. If you are filling out a formal offer to purchase, you will have to fill out one per offer with the creative details in the addendum. To view a sample letter of intent, as well as many other forms, log on to www.carltonsheetsrealbook.com. Tip: if you are working through a real estate agent, request to be present when your offer is presented to the seller. You will be able to explain any questions that the seller may have, as well as establish a sense of professionalism and build rapport. It should also be noted that these negotiating skills work equally well when you are either the buyer or the seller. As real estate investors, we tend to always think of ourselves as the buyer. But this is not necessarily true. In fact, in many instances, one of the best ways for you to turn a profit is by knowing when to sell one of your properties. This is especially true when you have bought a fixer-upper with the intent of flipping it for a significantly higher amount of money. Knowing how to use other people's money in creative ways can make it much easier for you to find buyers. And the negotiating tactics we've been discussing will come in handy for you when you are the buyer as well. Some good advice: basic do's and don'ts. I'm often asked for advice from my students, such as, should I do this deal? But mostly it's, how do I get started? Well, it's difficult to answer everyone's questions personally, but I've adhered to some guidelines over the years that have helped me and may help you get started. Carlton's do's and don'ts. Do keep an open mind. New ideas always seem strange at first. Imagine what it must have been like for the Wright brothers when they told people that they could fly. But new ideas can lead to a wonderful new way of life. And when it comes to real estate investments, the person with an open mind, who is always willing to entertain new ideas, is the kind of person who is most likely to succeed. Do write down your goals. It's amazing what a difference a piece of paper can make. Once your goals are committed to paper, you are much less likely to veer from your plans or to be distracted. Writing down your goals will also make you better organized and help you to maintain your focus. Having dreams and aspirations is a good thing. In fact, I strongly encourage it. That doesn't mean, of course, that you should keep your head in the clouds. Be a down-to-earth, practical, and realistic dreamer. Set achievable goals for yourself, and then enjoy the ride as you achieve them one by one. Do commit yourself 100%. Making goals is not enough. You must commit to achieving those goals. Set aside a reasonable amount of time and energy per day or per week to pursue your real estate-related activities. Stick to your schedule and don't be distracted. Small steps add up, and you will be surprised how much you have learned and how far you have progressed in a short amount of time. Don't listen to naysayers. As we all know, there are positive people in our lives and negative people. Some who want to see us succeed and others who would be jealous of our success. Negative people will always find reasons to tear you down and criticize what you're trying to do to improve your life. Do not listen to these people or let them influence you. They are not being your friends and will only hurt your chances for success. Don't be afraid to fail. The most successful people in the world have had more than their share of failures. They know all about the concept of trial and error. Don't be afraid of making mistakes. Instead, allow every failure to teach you a valuable lesson. However, always make sure that your worst-case scenarios are something you can afford to live with. If not, then the risk is too great, and you should move on to the next opportunity. Don't get emotional about a property. I realize that homes are often more than just buildings. They have emotional and sentimental value for the people who live in them. However, as an investor, you need to always keep in mind that this is a business, your business, and everyone involved in buying or selling real estate has a right to profit from each transaction, as long as it is conducted in an honest and ethical manner. The wave of the future. I have been involved with real estate investing for many years, and one thing I can say for sure is that the market is always changing and evolving. What might be true today may not be true tomorrow. As you know, there are buyer's markets and there are seller's markets. Compare 2005 to 2009. That's why success takes more than just learning a set-in-stone collection of rules. You have to be flexible and take into account the cyclical, ever-changing nature of the real estate market. All of the sources and techniques I've outlined in this chapter will work for both buying and selling properties. You have to determine which techniques will work best for you in a given situation and market. The United States recently experienced a sharp increase in the number of homes in foreclosure. This is a tragic situation for many homeowners. It happens for a variety of reasons. In short, people get into financial difficulties and can no longer afford the mortgage on their homes. For the investor, however, this means a large pool of highly motivated sellers. One of the most popular techniques involving foreclosures is known as a short sale. A short sale takes place when the lender agrees, with the homeowner's approval, to accept less than the amount owed on a piece of real estate. A short sale could happen for a few different reasons, but the most common is the value of the property has declined below the value of the loan. This could be due to the property being in distress, or it could simply be that values in the area have significantly declined since the property was purchased. Although foreclosures seem to be the buzzword between the years 2008 to 2009, don't overlook estate sales, tax liens, or tax deeds, depending on your state, or for sale by owner properties for leads to motivated sellers. That's one of the many things I love about real estate. You can find your own niche that best fits your goals and your level of risk. Tip. To learn more about how to invest in foreclosures, visit www.carltonsheetsrealbook.com for my complete foreclosures program, which is absolutely free. Another definite trend of the future, if you're not already using it, is using the power of the Internet. More than ever before, people have information at their fingertips, and they can demand answers at the touch of a send button. Almost any resource an investor would need is available almost instantaneously by searching the Internet. Using the Internet, you can search for local investment clubs for networking opportunities. For example, take a look at www.reiclub.com or www.creonline.com. Market your properties through online advertising or build your own customized website. Check out www.fsbo.com or www.forsalebyowner.com for buy owner opportunities. To build a specific website inexpensively, try www.yahoo.com or www.networksolutions.com. However, if you are looking for a pre-built website designed specifically for real estate investors, consider www.investorpro.com. Pinpoint properties that fit your investing profile through a variety of online service providers, including www.realtytrac.com, www.realtor.com, and www.fsbo.com. Search the public records online to find past sales prices and owner information, or even to find out how much neighbors, friends, or family paid for their homes. I recommend www.netronline.com for links to local county records. Find lenders. Try www.lendingtree.com or search Money Lenders on your favorite search engine. Go to www.carltonsheetsrealbook.com to access any site I have mentioned. The possibilities are endless, and this is by no means a comprehensive list, but my point is that it has never been as easy to find information, and all from the comfort of your own home. You can make money in any market. No matter what the market dictates, one fact remains constant. People still need a place to live. Whether they are renting or owning, there will always be situations where a growing family needs to upsize, or a retiree needs to downsize. The real estate market is never totally stagnant, and any market can be a good market to invest in as long as you know how and when to apply the techniques I've given you. Tip: you can tailor your real estate investing techniques to mirror market conditions. When the market is good, consider flipping properties. When the market is slow, consider buy and hold strategies. It's all up to you. The changes that have taken place in recent years within both the real estate market and the banking industry are actually very good changes for the savvy investor. And using my creative financing methods is likely to become even more necessary to succeed in real estate in the future. Banks now have lending requirements that are stricter than in the past, which potentially impact both buyers and sellers. When participants on both sides of the transaction have an even greater incentive to do things in a more innovative way, they will consider creative options that they may not have even thought of before. Ultimately, that sort of creativity is good for the market and can keep it a dynamic, ever-changing arena where good ideas and strong visions are handsomely rewarded. Ways to learn more. Visit Carlton Sheets on the web at www.carltonsheetsrealbook.com. This site is your source for all things real estate. You'll find many of Carlton's best-selling real estate programs online for free, as well as links to web resources, current trends, and real estate news, blogs, products and services, and a forum for networking with other investors nationwide.
Carlton Sheets is recognized as the best-selling author of the No Down Payment Home Study Course, as well as other successful real estate books, video, and audio programs. He has sold more than 3 million copies of his programs in the United States alone. In 1984, Carlton partnered with the Professional Education Institute to distribute his message nationally about creative real estate investing. His No Down Payment television program is now accredited as being the longest-running program of its kind, spanning 25 years. After 30 years of successfully selling his programs, Carlton began sharing his real estate programs online at no charge. His wish is to reach as many people as possible to help them achieve their dreams, as he has achieved his with real estate. Today, on his own or with partners, Carlton has bought and sold more than $50 million of commercial and residential income-producing real estate.
17. W. Scott Shermer. Entitlements. The Sleeping Giant of Real Estate Profitability. Scott is my neighbor. He lives directly across the street from Kim and me. Every year, our neighborhood has a number of parties, and at every party, I look forward to seeing Scott and asking him for his views on the world of money, real estate, and investing. Not only is he a neighbor, but he is a great friend and someone I look to when I need more sophisticated information on the subject of real estate. One aspect of real estate is politics. Being a developer, Scott needs to be tuned into the local politics of the areas he is developing. Being a developer means he must be looking years into the future, years before he breaks ground. As some of you know, many times a worthy project, a project that will lift the value of the area, will be shot down by local neighborhood organizations that are resistant to change. This is where politics comes in. I do not care where you live. Politics and real estate go hand in hand. Local politics and politicians can improve or destroy the value of the real estate in an area. For example, at our last Christmas party, I was asking Scott about a local Arizona politician and that person's relationship to the police department. It was Scott's point of view that this politician and the police did not see eye to eye. That is why the crime in this one area was increasing and values of the property were going down. I did not invest in the area based on Scott's view of the future of this area of town. Today, many people who did invest in that once friendly neighborhood are losing financially as crime infects the area. This means, when I talk to Scott, I am often talking politics, but really I am discussing real estate. If you are to become a professional real estate investor, you must, and I do mean must, have a person like Scott who you can talk to about local politics and then talk about real estate. Robert Kiyosaki.
Tip: the current financial crisis in the United States is likely to be judged in retrospect as the most wrenching since the end of the Second World War. Alan Greenspan, former U.S. Federal Reserve Chair, March 17, 2008. Missing from Mr. Greenspan's assessment is the other side of the coin. Those getting into a critical aspect of real estate now, who prepare for the eventual upturn, will be among the most successful in gaining wealth and security. How can that happen? This chapter will show you how to add value to real estate today, often without even owning or developing it, to capitalize on large returns tomorrow. Whether you want to work in the area of entitlements or not, it is important that you understand this critical area of real estate. The knowledge can make you money, and it can make your life easier. Ask yourself a question. When you drive around your state or across the country, do you ever wonder who owns those acres and miles of raw land? The answer is that someone possesses every square inch of it, and it is owned by the federal government, the state, the county, the city, the Indian nation, or a private party such as a company or an individual. Most people believe that private parties are the biggest property owners of our country, but this is not necessarily true. In Arizona, for example, only 15% of the land is privately owned. Another illusion when it comes to real estate is if you own land as a private property owner, then you can do what you want with it. You own your property, you pay taxes, you buy insurance for it, and you maintain it. You own the right to do all that, but what you do not own is the right to do anything you want with the property. Surprised? This is where the term entitlement enters the equation, and it is not a complicated concept. It simply means what you are entitled or allowed to do with your property, as defined by the city, county, or state in which the land is located with regard to development. Those decisions are controlled by entitlements granted by the federal, state, county, or local government agencies. These agencies tell you whether your land is usable for agricultural, commercial, residential, or industrial uses. They tell you how much you can build on your property, whether you can remove vegetation, how to mitigate wildlife disturbances that exist on your property, whether you have rights to access streets, water, or sewer, and whether a septic system is permitted, along with many other governmental controls. Tip: here is an old adage that will serve you well today and tomorrow. In reality, owning an asset is not as important as controlling an asset, and those who entitle an asset have the potential to obtain great profits from their endeavors. Love thy neighbor? Today, one of the most unquantifiable controlling factors that involves the use of your property is your neighbor, a factor that has historically caused owners and developers much grief. Neighbors have always held that they should have a say about what is done with a vacant lot they view over or visit now and forever. Today, more than ever, neighbors believe they have an inherent right to use a parcel of land as they see fit. Parking, playing, cycling, jogging, walking, dumping, and controlling it, even if that vacant lot now happens to be your property. Neighbors feel that when it comes to your property, whether vacant or with existing structures on it, you, the property owner, should abide by their rules and wishes. Because I've heard these complaints so often, I've given them their own name and formalized the list into the top 20 neighborly complaints for non-development. Are these complaints fictitious? Believe me, I could never make this stuff up. Each one is based on a real-life situation I have experienced, and I marvel at the list every time I read it. All developments, whether residential, commercial, or industrial, have many of the same neighborhood concerns. Commercial development adds the apprehension that you may be bringing people from other areas of the community into their neighborhood. Industrial development embodies fears about pollution and the potential hazards of large vehicles in the area. These neighbor issues have always been present, but to a lesser degree than what they are today. There are two reasons for this increase in neighborly concern. One. There has been a shift of political thought in the country from an attitude of self-reliance to an attitude of rights and entitlements. Your project might be the proper development for the site, but the neighborly feeling is, not in my backyard. Such people are commonly referred to as NIMBYs. Two. There has been an increase in the ability for a small group of NIMBYs or activists to organize a vocal minority of people through the Internet. The Internet has changed the political landscape. What has not changed is the axiom that a squeaky wheel does get the oil. And on the Internet, a little squeaking goes a long way in creating an adverse situation between neighbors and owners. Here is my list of the top 20 neighborly complaints for non-development. Do not change the height of the existing building, for it will hurt our privacy. We have always walked across the land and must continue to do so. You will disturb the habitat of existing animals, and this you must not do. We will not be able to see over or across the land, for you will block our view. You will create traffic, and that is unacceptable to us. Development will overburden the number of children in the schools. You must not change the character and compatibility of the neighborhood. The old building that is on your property is historic. Do not touch it. There are rare biological plants that must be nurtured forever. The apartment complex you want to develop will bring in undesirable people. Your development will import crime into the neighborhood. Whatever you do will not be environmentally friendly, so you may not do it. The developer is out of state, and we are wary and suspicious. The developer is greedy, and we are not. End of discussion. If we let the owner develop, it should be with less density. The owner should take less money for the property. Any development will increase noise, and that is not good. The lights from the development will destroy the night sky. The city is too crowded, and we do not want anyone else in our neighborhood. If we refuse to let you build the roads, people will not come, and that is good. Our society has evolved in a way that is less social in nature and more segregated geographically in political thoughts and beliefs. As someone who grew up in the Midwest, I knew all of our neighbors. We watched out for each other. I had a feeling of self-reliance, but I knew my neighbors were there for me if I needed help, and I was there for them. It was a close reflection of the Ozzie and Harriet Nelson Society. Moving to the West, I find our communities are developing in a way that segregates people. Neighbors are transient. They don't know each other. There is little feeling of community and of looking out for each other. It has forced people to push what they perceive as their rights onto others. The Nelsons have given way to the Simpsons and married with children. Assembling this disenfranchised group is easy through the Internet because it provides empowerment, and it offers pervasive access to large numbers of people almost instantaneously. This, in turn, creates a purpose for social gathering, often led by a vocal resident who feels validated to carry the cause, the self-appointed squeaky wheel. Why have I spent time talking about this? Because whether you realize it or not, it is not your desires but the vote of the politicians to whom you present your product for approval that determines the use of your property. And it is the NIMBYs who elect and therefore influence those politicians who hold the cards. Tip: all politics is local. Representative Tip O'Neill, late Speaker of the House. The world of local politics. Is it just me, or have politicians changed over the years? To better serve your community is no longer a motivation to run for office. It has become a campaign slogan void of reality. It seems that a large number of elected officials are in political office for their own personal gain. They want the office as a career. Indeed, they feel as entitled to it as the neighbors who embrace a personal ownership of the property you own. Once such politicians have tasted the power, control, and benefits of their positions, they will do whatever is necessary to keep their positions. Therefore, a small group of vocal voters do make a huge difference in the outcome of your project. Real-life story: the politician who wasn't. As young people starting out in real estate development, my colleagues and I assembled 100 adjoining parcels in a rundown area of Phoenix and presented a master plan for redevelopment to the Phoenix City Council for approval. 200 people showed up to rally against the redevelopment. I remember Mayor Margaret Hance standing up in front of the angry crowd and wagging her finger, telling the crowd how good this was for the city. The project passed over neighborhood opposition. Mayor Hance was a leader, not because she voted for a project I was involved in, but because she took a stand in support of a project that may have been against her own personal political interest, but that was nonetheless good for the city. She was a popular mayor in Phoenix, in part because she was recognized for caring about the city. She was also an exceptional politician, because she didn't act like one. Most of the time, you will not be dealing with that kind of leadership. You will be dealing with quite the opposite. Real-life story: the politician who was. Recently, I made an application for a mixed-use residential development in the city of Phoenix for my firm, M3 Companies. There was NIMBY opposition from a group that elected a councilman from the district in which this parcel was located. Before City Council heard the application, this councilman announced he was against the development. He said he needed to take an early stand, that he was showing leadership. In this case, he was afraid to do what was best for the city. He wanted to appease the vocal NIMBYs for his own political gain. I'd like to say this is a rare occurrence, but it is not. You will find this behavior to be very common in today's political landscape. Entitlements equals profits. Are entitlements difficult to secure? The answer is yes. Then why not purchase property that has already been entitled? You can. and most developers do. But you can make a lot of money by entitling property for yourself or for others without the financing or capital risk that other areas of real estate require. Entitlement can be a profitable area of real estate just by relying on your learned skills. Your profits have nothing to do with how much money you have to buy real estate. There are three secrets to entitlements that lead to success and great profitability. You will hear them from me more than once in this chapter. Please remember, 1. Knowledge. 2. Knowledge. 3. Knowledge. How do you obtain this knowledge? To quote from J.R.R. Tolkien, with apologies to the Lord of the Rings, "The tale grew in the telling." The way I gained my knowledge was by starting slowly and deliberately, and from there I worked my way to a comfort level where I could begin to take action. You can start and grow this way too, only I'm going to make it easier for you with my reality-based, detailed entitlement process. Each area is based on what I've learned, and these guidelines continue to serve me well. The remainder of this chapter is about the process, and it contains everything I do to profit from entitlements. You'll find this process to be a huge advantage as you learn, but it will be only as valuable as your willingness to put in the time and rely on self-motivation and determination. There are no shortcuts to building a knowledge base, but there are long-term gains to be made. Give yourself at least 6 months to acquire the foundation necessary to succeed. Scott's Detailed Entitlement Process. Know your city or county plans, ordinances, and ways of doing business. Become knowledgeable with your city's or county's goals and planning. This will help you understand what the city or town is doing or plans to do and why. You also need to understand how business is conducted to avoid rookie mistakes. Trust me, I have made them. Your mission: study the general plan for your city or town. Read the zoning code and ordinances. Learn how the game is played. Think in terms of how you can benefit the politicians, not the other way around. Be on top of city and town politics. Learn the political structure. Every city or town is governed by elected and staff individuals. I will get to them in a minute. Developing relationships is important, and believe it or not, mayors and council members are approachable. Why? Because they are always looking for new people to help secure their positions and advance their self-interests. This is not cynicism. It is the way of the world. Real-life story. When a whole, H-O-L-E, is not the whole, W-H-O-L-E. I acquired a 20-acre piece of property that was in a great location, but was a massive hole. It was an eyesore to the community and was preventing a major road from being built in the area. This property would require 600,000 cubic yards of compacted, clean dirt to fill the hole. For reference, a large dump truck carries about 18 cubic yards of dirt. So when I say it was a big hole, I mean it. It would take about 33,000 dump truck loads to fill it. I wanted to develop a commercial shopping center on the property, which would require that I change the zoning from residential to commercial. The city was enthusiastic and said it would support my application. I deeded the right-of-way the city needed to allow for the development of the road. That was my first major mistake. Then I made the application to rezone the property. The process would take 6 months. Immediately after applying for rezoning, a contractor approached me with a request to dispose of dirt from a nearby canal project he had been awarded. He would fill the hole in my property with clean, compacted dirt at no cost to me. Naturally, I thought I had hit a home run, since I would not have to pay to fill the hole. It took the contractor 3 months of night and day hauling of dirt to fill the property. The property looked great when it was completed. That was my second mistake. Timing is everything. And as fate would have it, my rezoning request was heard before the city council a month after I had filled the unsightly hole. I was thrilled. I had held up my end of the bargain. As fate would also have it, at the city council hearing, a number of NIMBY residents turned out to protest my application. They didn't want commercial zoning in their neighborhood. Astonishingly, the politician who promised me his support, pre-right-of-way and pre-hole, suddenly had a change of heart and led the charge against my rezoning request. It turned out that with the roadway and hole problem solved in his district, he was now worried only about votes. Thanks to my fine work, he had the right-of-way for the city road, and he had the eyesore problem solved. His job was done. He had the whole enchilada. Lesson learned. Make sure that you receive what is promised to you before you perform your end of an obligation with a politician. A lifelong friend of mine, Dr. Mark Horowitz, is both a businessman and a scholar of early Tudor England, who has spent much of his life researching and understanding the relationships between those in power and those who benefit from the powerful. In a special issue of the journal Historical Research, commemorating the 500th anniversary of the death of the first Tudor king, 1509 to 2009, Mark defines politics as the pursuit of self-interest and self-preservation through the use of power. Henry VII is a model for all leaders and for those seeking benefits from them when it comes to cultivating relationships for political ends. Half the battle is simply showing up. The same is true for you. For example, on Tuesday, go to the planning committee meetings, and on Thursday, the council meetings. In between, hold meetings with staff members and make appointments with developers. Go to their functions, help them, learn about them, and become known to them. Position yourself positively. When it comes time for you to make an application, they will all know you, which will go miles in helping you get your project approved. Tip: remember, those in power are motivated by self-interest and self-preservation, and they are looking for new faces and new ideas to help them with both. These are the critical players in any city or town that you will want to get to know, and that you will want to know you. The staff. The staff in the planning departments are a constant. They are government employees until they retire. Politicians, on the other hand, are elected every 2 or 4 years. Politicians and elected officials come and go. The staff in the planning department stay year after year. They play a very important role in the political support for your project, your mission. Meet the planning staff. Get to know them personally. Take them out to lunch, a cup of coffee, or play golf with them. Ask for their help. Make your project their idea. Self-interests, remember. Understand how they think. Appointed boards or neighborhood groups. Even though these groups may be informal and volunteer-based, they are powerful and should not be underestimated. Your mission: go to every neighborhood meeting. Get on neighborhood boards. Determine the leadership structure and who the decision makers are. Planning Commission. This usually consists of a board whose members are appointed by the elected members of the city council. Their decisions are usually advisory only, but they serve an important role as political cover to members of the city council. Your mission: go to every planning commission hearing and meet every planning commission member. Get to know them and learn their backgrounds. Make friends with them. Understand how they vote and determine which of them are business friendly and which are neighborhood friendly. Understand the alliances they form and why. Determine whose vote you need to pass your project through. Support their ambitions and causes. City Council. This is the ultimate voting body. It will make or break your project, And it has the power to hold it up indefinitely. Your mission? Go to every city council hearing. Meet the mayor and every city council member. Support them politically. Become their friends. Get to know all members and what their hot buttons are, and try pushing a few. Become known and trusted by them. Understand how they vote and know which ones are business.